I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/achieve today.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Hey, I'm Guy Raz, and on my show, Wisdom from the Top, I talk with CEOs and business leaders about the toughest challenges of their careers.
There's lots of ways to measure success.
Sometimes a company has to bet against itself.
We wanted to set ourselves apart by having a point of view.
Businesses really impact people's lives in pretty fundamental ways.
On Wisdom from the Top, some of the greatest business leaders of our time share their intimate stories of leadership, innovation, and transformation. Stories you won't hear anywhere else. Check out Wisdom from the Top only on Luminary. Now, back to your show.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.
The Telegraph. The Telegraph. Podcasts.
Hey everyone, how was your weekend? Did you watch any rugby? You're once again joined by Ben Coles, that's me, Charlie Morgan, say hi Charlie.
Hello Colesy.
And Charles Richardson, say hi Charles.
Hello.
We're back from France via plane, train and train again to recap a fun opening weekend of Rugby World Cup 2023, which translates as what, Charles?
Fun weekend of Rugby La Coupe du Monde 2023.
Marvellous, marvellous. You're basically a local at this point.
Yeah.
We'll also be hearing later in this episode from former Wales winger Shane Williams to get his thoughts on that wild game with Fiji and what lies ahead for Warren St. Gatland's Wales in the rest of the tournament. I was in Bordeaux. Charlie, first of all, where were you? And then Charles, where were you?
I was in Marseille. Absolutely loved it. Vibey city, lovely weather, great stadium, fantastic atmospheres in both games. Wicked lunch at the beach before a game. Never done that before. So, pumped to be back.
I was in Paris for the build-up to the big one. Then, somewhat infamously, I was at Australia v Georgia on Saturday, which we'll come on to. And then shot down to Bordeaux on Sunday for the game of the weekend, Wales v Fiji. And then back to the studio yesterday.
I think that's what they call a tease in the game for something coming up later in the episode, Charles. Look forward to getting to that. What's your highlight of the weekend, gents? What's your favourite moment, favourite try? Charlie?
Perhaps ironically, given the problems before the England-Argentina game, just arriving at the Stade Vélodrome for both of those games and seeing kind of fans from both nations interact, Pumas fans, quite a young demographic, absolutely just vociferous, and that game was always going to be really loud. Real shame, obviously, what happened with the fans, I think, arriving later. But then the next day for Scotland, South Africa, it was sort of smoothed over, a bit of an earlier kickoff. But that sort of festival atmosphere, really good natured generally, that really felt like that the tournament had arrived for me.
Probably the Sammy Randranger drop. Now we were both there. But it just encapsulated the drama of a complete, it's sort of slobber knocker of a match. After that match, we were the same. It's very steep there. Anyone who was in Bordeaux would know this. The stadium is very steep, and we were walking down the stairs at the end, and my legs were a bit sort of jellified, and I thought I was genuinely going to stack it down the stairs. And that was because of that sort of thrilling, dramatic climax.
You were actively complaining that your feet were too big for the steps, and you were worried about falling off the edge of each step as you went.
Very steep staircase, very tiny steps with size 13 feet, so do the maths.
Quick highlight for me was getting to Bordeaux on Friday and finding an excellent spot to watch France, New Zealand, but getting to this spot so early that we had to hold it down for about 2.5 hours before kickoff. And getting to watch all of TF1 sort of build-up coverage of the World Cup, which was I haven't really experienced much of. It's sort of on a different level.
Mika and Seb Chabal.
Yeah, at one point, Mika the pop star and Seb Chabal together, and also about half an hour of the France team bus being followed as if it was in like a high-speed chase through the streets of Paris with like really wobbly motorbike cameras. It was just on it. It was on a new level to what I'm used to, and I thoroughly enjoyed it. Best game, quickly, from the three of us. I think I'll say Wales Fiji. It was quite hard to top. Charles?
Yep, total agreement.
Agreed. Both of mine were quite compelling for different reasons, but yeah, that was caught the second half of that in my hotel room on the way back from Scotland to South Africa, and would have really could have done with going to sleep actually, but there was no chance of that.
I hope that that might end up being the best game by the end of the tournament. I hope it won't be, because I hope we'll have more sort of zingers to compare it to. But that was an awesome start. I had a chance to speak to Shane Williams the morning after about that, and we got into sort of the nuances of that game, the penalties against Wales that came up. So we'll dig into that a bit, but also how well Wales defended, how they sort of resisted what was an amazing comeback. And he's got some thoughts as well on how Wales are sort of using Lewis Rhys-Emmett or not using Lewis Rhys-Emmett, and also what's ahead for the players from Gatland and the coaches after, once again, they left it a little bit late to just get over the line and made it a bit scary for themselves. One of the other talking points from the weekend, of course, was the national anthems, which we're still waiting for confirmation on from the organising committee. But there's a lot of chat that the children's choir recordings might be in the bin. And I'm going to guess, Charles, that we wouldn't mind that, because they weren't great, were they?
No. I mean, the Marseillaise on Friday night, I was there in the ground and it was just a complete butchery. Like, from start to finish, it was, it was not the way that you wanted to start the tournament off.
Because you're gearing up for that to be stirring.
Yeah, and it usually very much is. I mean, we went out France-Australia in the warm-ups, but just chatting to a few of the journalists there, they said that the anthem there was the loudest they've ever heard it. I was at France-South Africa last year in Marseille, and that was sort of deafening. And also the Welsh one, Land of Our Fathers, on the Welsh anthem on Sunday night, the track was just far too quick. And the stadium with the acoustics of 45,000 people singing and it going from one side of the
it's
other.
It's like three different versions going on.
Just couldn't keep
it?
Up. And yeah. I don't know what the players would have been doing on the field, and they were doing something different to one stand, to another stand, to another stand, to the soundtrack. It was all a great big mess. Apparently, I haven't watched the anthems back yet on ITV. It came across okay on television, but let me tell you, it was not good in the ground.
Argentina's wasn't too bad live, but I think that's partly because you've got that big long intro, haven't you? And then I think by the time it kicks in, I think the fans sort of took over the kind of horror movie children's bit. So
Home Alone.
It was, yeah. That's a great shout. No, so that was actually all right. But the others like, actually Gregor Townsend got asked and sort of insisted we actually really liked it. I think South Africa were asked the same thing, but they were sort of on the same wavelength. They said out loud that they liked it, but no, I wouldn't be gutted to see a change.
That was one of the post match questions.
You get 15 minutes, don't you? And we've spoken about Jesse Creel's non red card and missed chances by Scotland. So what else was that?
Do you think
about?
It's because Scotland are sort of semi-used to an a cappella version? Because at Murrayfield, the bagpipes stop after the first verse, don't they?
A cappella, but good.
Yeah,
yeah, so. Yeah. I've written a comment about it on the website. They don't work. But respect to the kids for doing a cappella versions of the big build-up in the Argentina anthem.
To the kids
and the Italy one as well. Gents, can you also use this opportunity to plug a piece that you've written? What have you got on the go? What's on the website?
Can you please read a look at how England adapted to that? They've got no excuse not to be able to adapt to red cards now, because they keep shipping them. But I looked at how they scrum formations, just the energy of Ben Earl, a few nuances in their kicking game, Freddie Stewart not kicking from the backfield and linking with George Ford, who was kicking. So Freddie Stewart was more of a weapon on the chase. They can get loads better, obviously, and we'll get into that. The way they moved the ball wasn't good enough to go deep in the tournament. They'll hope that will get better. But the fundamentals of their game were just so much better, and that piece looks at them.
And after Charlie's rapier, I come in with the bludgeon. I've written a rant on the website about refereeing at the tournament and how it's very, very sad and depressing that after the first weekend, which should have been glittering, the agenda and the narrative has been dominated by officialdom and refereeing decisions, and how it's not necessarily the fault of the officials themselves that rugby has got itself into a state where the mechanisms of the game don't necessarily match up too well with the laws and the interpretations, and it's the job for referees has never been more difficult. And I just think that it's worrying, because on Saturday night for England Argentina, if you were watching that as a casual fan or even as a new fan, you would probably have absolutely no idea why Tom Curry was sent off and Santiago Carrera survived. And frankly, I'm not sure I could explain it to you.
I feel like we can use "I've written a rant" on the website as like an evergreen clip moving forward. Speaking of Marseille, let's get into it. Let's talk about England's win. It almost feels like weeks ago now, that Marseille game, because of what happened in Bordeaux. But a truly impressive performance from England in lots of areas. Not all, but particularly with their physicality and their defence and George Ford's control of the game and how they reacted to that red card. Charlie, how excited should people be, and are we being a bit curmudgeon-y if we're like, yeah, but your attack's still rubbish?
Yeah, maybe, yeah, because I think we spoke last week, didn't we, about the areas of the game that we just felt so disparate for England. They weren't connected at all. Everything apart from that last bit, which is that ball movement to space, really was really good, I thought, post Tom Curry's red card, certainly. The energy on the kick chase, the accuracy of that kick, their fitness, shock. Alan Walters knows what he's doing. Mm. They looked really, really intense throughout the game. Overran a side with a man fewer for all but 10 minutes. Yeah, they were excellent set piece. Maratogi deserves a lot of credit for marshalling that line out. Scrum looked great with eight players when one of three centres was at blindside flanker, and when they had seven. Really interesting wrinkle to the game. Argentina only had two put-ins, which and that was when England were going down to seven to keep Manu Tuilagi and Joe Marchant in midfield. But you know, we were thinking, look, when is this England side going to exude clarity? When is this England side going to look fit? We got our answer. They were those things, certainly.
Yeah, and a massive win for those who have been lamenting the disappearance of the drop goal as well, and, you know, brought it back in emphatic fashion, George Ford. Yeah, no, really impressed by England. I think they would have played the same way had they had 15 or 14 on the field, and I think that's potentially the only negative that can be brought from that game is that going further and looking sort of beyond the quarterfinals now, I mean, surely they will be in a quarterfinal now, touch wood. I mean, I don't want to jinx it for them. But looking beyond that, maybe they might need to bring more. But it was a phenomenal start and completely blindsided most people. Although last week, not meaning to blow our own trumpet, we did say sort of on the podcast, we know it's been bad in August, but they might be building something and to keep the faith.
I don't really want to get into predictions because that was the one that I got right and then the other two. So yeah, I'm sorry if you put a fiver on France not to get out of the group, basically.
or Georgia beating Australia. But moving on. And but keeping on the theme of predictions, I'm feeling very vindicated by mine after the complete shower that Argentina were of Samoa getting out of that group, because that was one of the worst performances from a Tier 1 nation I can remember for a very long time. In fact, they dropped more passes or more balls than any Tier 1 nation since 2007, I think Opta said on Twitter last night. I mean, we're big fans of Argentina, and we've got a lot of their players in our top 100 on the website, but it was a real bad night at the office for them.
Steve Borthwick's sides make you play badly, especially when they connect those facets of performance that we talked about. But I think a lot of credit, the drop goal strategy, not only did it, that's what happens when that scoreboard keeps moving, doesn't it? It sows seeds of anxiety, and on a kind of sultry, humid night, when it was difficult for moving the ball, Argentina had to move the ball more, and then that's a vicious circle for them. And they just couldn't get out of it. And to be honest, they were rattled straight to the Santiago Carrera's challenge on Ford was just brainless. And that was kind of, you know, where's that coming from? There's just no clear thinking there. It looked like they were in the same mindset that England were in during England's warm-ups.
His yellow card, it was obviously far from ideal for Argentina. But his whole, the whole selection of him at 10 has been quite interesting over the last 2 years because it's been based around this attacking game and he's the one who gets the best out of them. It's not, his selection is not necessarily built for structure. He can tactical kick, obviously, but he's not the kind of, you would go for a safer fly half if you wanted that. And so I think, yeah, once they got behind and they were chasing the game against a defence that didn't work, they didn't have the same kind of 10 who could come on and put them into the right positions necessarily to get back into it.
Yeah, two things there. The sort of upside of Santiago Carreras at fly half was crystallised in the try that he sets up within that loop play at Twickenham last November. Yep. They tried that again in the second half against England. Manu Tuilagi was at 12 rather than 13. Manu Tuilagi steams forward, smashes Santiago Chocobares, and it's a really kind of tone-setting moment for that second half and it kind of encapsulates what's been going on throughout the rest of the game. The other thing is his challenge on Ford. He's got away with the yellow card and no sighting. Super ironic point is that Malia is so similar to the Malia challenge on Grant Williams during the Rugby Championship, which was unpunished at the time, but then led to a 2-week ban. And Steve Borthwick doesn't go into these incidences during his post-match pressers, but he did say, yeah, I was pretty surprised that was only a yellow. And actually, if you think about it, it's very similar to an incident a couple of weeks ago, or a month or so ago, where somebody got a 2-week ban. So, and he sort of left it hanging. But no, that's, you're right, Colsey. That it was a sort of indicative of how the Santiago Carreras' performance was sort of indicative of what went wrong for Argentina.
Charles, Santiago Chocobares, or has somebody texted you with an alternative name for him?
Santiago Chocobales. So when he knocked on, yeah, that one goes out to my father. Just one thing on Argentina, just very quickly, is I think their entire night can be encapsulated and embodied by the fact that they had clearly spent some time developing what they believed was quite a sophisticated wall move, which we were all very excited about when they set up for it, and then proceeded to make a complete and utter horlicks of it. England defended it very well, but it did just look like, I don't know, sort of a Pac-Man gone wrong, sort of just people flying everywhere, just bodies everywhere, and it was really messy, really clumsy.
Yeah, I mean, we could spend probably 10 minutes absolutely tearing Argentina apart. I had the joy of doing player ratings and I was chucking out fours and threes and even a two, actually.
Oh, you got that.
I'll let you guess. Can you guess quickly who might have got a two?
Tell me.
Yeah.
Thomas Gallo.
Of course, because Dan Cole had him on toast.
The loose head, because Dan Cole killed him. And then in attack, he made critical errors at terrible times when Argentina were actually in field position. I want to do something we haven't done. I want to lavish more praise on England. Can you talk to me, Charlie, about the physicality from Courtney Laws, Maro Toje Vold? Felt like Maro Toje Vold, didn't it? And also Ben Earlin and how good he was.
He's got a lot of heat, Maro Toje, but he's been consistently good when England have been really up against it. So Ireland in the 2022 Six Nations, after Charlie Yule's red card, he was phenomenal. He was pretty sneakily good at the end of the game against Wales, that they pulled out of the trash after all of that carnage, including Owen Farrell's red card. He's very good when you don't have the ball very much. He's so energetic, racks up a massive tackle count. He's so disruptive around the breakdown. Those were the things that he could do. Alongside Courtney Laws was phenomenal. I text actually one of our editors during the game. During the warm-up, I felt like he, as captain, he was always, after those warm-ups where he's such an experienced player, sort of he would have taken that month to just get himself ready after a season where he hasn't had that much rugby, and he just exploded into that. Those two, Laws had to, I thought the turning point of the game, start of the second quarter, after that war move, I think it's Earl, Itoje and Laws that smash Kramer off the back of the war move. Laws somehow scrapes himself out of that breakdown through the legs of Thomas Gajo, and he's on his feet after Jamie George and Ollie Chessum stop the pick and go of Junior Montoya. He's over the ball, and I think it's Cadella that goes off his feet. Huge moment, and you can see Dan Cole is celebrating like he scored a hat-trick. George Ford steams in, usually quite collected on the pitch, and is celebrating like England have scored a try. It's a huge moment. I thought... just to go back to the Curry red, for Earl to be as prominent without Curry on the pitch, that's so impressive, because that speaks to an energy where you're effectively doing the job of two quite similar all action flankers. And I think that might actually, that's certainly a reason to mitigate England's sort of attacking woes, because I think they would have got Curry holding width out wide, and like he did in the Premiership final. So they might not have him now for a couple of weeks, but that's one thing that they can hang their hat on, and that's where that area of the game will get better.
Charles, can I just come to you on George Ford's performance? Mm. I mean, the drop kicks were great. The one from basically halfway was particularly fantastic, but also how he moved England around. I can't remember who it was now, but somebody said it should go down as one of the great England performances in a World Cup game, with how he sort of took charge of proceedings. Would you chime along with that?
100%, yeah. He was phenomenal. He was the player that we've always seen on his very best days at club, finally translated onto the international stage. We always know he had the potential to do it, and he has had excellent games in an England shirt, but none quite as domineering as that, I think. And, in 9 points in how many minutes? What it would have been, 10 minutes, something like that, those three drop goals. That was it. That was game over. Even at the time, you sort of, that felt game over, because Argentina had chances, they were man up, and then in 10 minutes, they were suddenly 9 points behind going into half time. They only had 3 points to show themselves. And then it was just all England from there. It was all England. I mean, yeah, and I'm all for the return of the drop goal. I mean, genuinely very, very shocked. I don't think any of us were expecting that. It was peak Steve Borthwick, really. It was tactical, it was strategic. The players found a way out for themselves. It was everything that we hadn't really seen much of with England in the warm-ups, suddenly coming to life with the click of the fingers, which everyone, including us, probably doubted could happen.
It was sort of hidden in plain sight, because we've seen a lot of the social media content coming out of the England camp has been them just hitting drop goals, Smith, Farrell and Ford and Henry Slade before he was sort of overlooked. Really interesting, but it's classic Steve Borthwick, is leaving one little wrinkle that you're not thinking about. And that's what he did at Leicester a lot, was those big games, kept saying again during the build-up to this game, we are in the warm-up games when they weren't going that well, we are preparing for Argentina. Left a little bit there just as an add-on. And that, when the rest of the game came together as it wasn't doing during the warm-ups, that added up to a really impressive performance.
There's more than one way to skin a cat, isn't there? And was it entertaining? Well, I mean, no tries, but I think it was entertaining. And it just proves that rugby can be very diverse and very varied, and you can still find entertainment. And it doesn't all have to be about Fijian chucking the ball around. Don't get me wrong, love that as well. But actually, I mean, I don't know about you two, but I was phenomenally entertained by England on Saturday night. As a neutral, really, I didn't really have a dog in the fight, and I just thought this is amazing, and how innovative, really, how it was innovation, but very much the drop goal is a very big part of rugby anyway. So it was strange.
It's like peak World Cup tactics, isn't it? Like go to the thing which is going to guarantee you points. And England, after the Wales game in Cardiff and after the game against Ireland in Dublin, the other areas went wrong, but afterwards they would cite their lack of being able to convert territory into points as their biggest issue. So what's one way to get points if your attack really still isn't working? Kick a drop goal. Mm. And it wouldn't shock me if that's just how they're going to play it now. If they get in the 22 and they go four or five phases and they think, actually, we're not getting anywhere here, ball is slowing down in the ruck, well, let's just drop George Ford back and knock 3 points out.
Don't even need to get into the opposition 22. You can't have a crap efficient rate in the opposition 22 if you don't even have to get to the 22.
No, yeah, quite. Yeah. And what do we think about Farrell?
Well, yeah, it needs to be talked about.
Right. So one of the first reactions to I think our readers was Owen Farrell could never do that, which I kind of found seriously reductive anyway, but also made me think, I'm fairly sure he's been in a lot of backs to the wall performances. And actually look back, so back end of 2016, which again, this game had gone totally out of my mind, back end of 2016, England host Argentina at Twickenham, Elliot Daly gets sent off in the fourth minute. George Ford is on the field for a lot of that game, but Owen Farrell's at 12. And if you watch highlights of that game, he's involved in a big turnover that leads to their first try, and they end up beating Argentina really comfortably in a game that's actually pretty similar, except that they've got an attacking edge. Now, I think that attack, I think they move the ball better with Owen Farrell on the pitch. and having that Ford and Farrell axis. The pinch point for me is whether that midfield is more vulnerable, because I think they might be inclined to push too laggy to 13, and we've just seen that get exposed, that Farrell on the outside, that Farrell having too laggy at 13 now. So it's a huge decision, and we don't actually have to come to it for another couple of weeks, do we? Because he's not available for the next game.
They wanted Ford Farrell against Ireland, didn't they? I mean, that was the sound. And actually, that's probably the way they wanted to start the World Cup, with Slade not being in the squad. It makes sense that they would potentially want to go down that route.
Where they're at, all of a sudden, where England are at, is that I think their supporters would hope that Steve Borthwick wouldn't think that Farrell coming back or Bully Vunipola coming back would be an automatic choice, because he can tailor a game plan to an opponent. And that doesn't have to have those guys on the pitch now, as that performance has shown in its composure and in its kind of convincing nature.
Yeah, I do think Farrell will come back at 12. I do think that in sort of gun to head now, I do think Farrell will come back at 12. And then it's about who plays 13. I mean, realistically, I think that Marchant went well, and I do rate Marchant a lot. But I think if it's Ford Farrell, has it not got to be Lawrence? Has it not got to be Lawrence for more ball in hand
playing
threat?
So well, though, Manu is the last two games.
But they're just so defensively prone with Farrell and Manu, though. That's the thing. I wouldn't want to drop Manu. I'm just thinking about the balance of the back line, and it's not an individual criticism of Manu or Joe Marchant. I'd have them both in my team if I could, but maybe Marchant pushes to the wing. But I just think that maybe with Ford Farrell, you might want the running threat of Lawrence and a sort of out-and-out outside centre at 13.
Just 2 points on England to finish off this section. The first thing we need to talk about is the sort of chaos that fans had trying to get into the game. I mean, I think we all had friends or family members texting us describing it. It's actually quite a scary atmosphere. Charlie, did you get to see any of that when you were in the ground?
I was already in the ground, but saw it out the back and had, acquaintances kind of telling me how scary it was. It sounded like if the crowd hadn't sort of been inherently good natured, I think it would have been really, really messy, because from the Rond-Point du Prado, which is the metro stop that you come off in Marseille, and then you walk up to the Stade Vélodrome, there are these steps that go up, and I think a lot of the queuing was happening sort of over those steps, and that could have been really quite horrible. It was cleared up by the next day for Scotland South Africa, which we got a statement, didn't we? A media statement saying that we'd been assured that there would be a kind of better contingencies in place from the policing around the ground, and it did seem that was the case. Although it might just have been that fans had seen that and had chosen to get there earlier. It seemed like the most of the trouble was being experienced by people who'd arrived at the ground at eight, sort of around eight, and then had tried to get in from there and had met a total standstill, but. I mean, it was still, it's really good that was resolved. And I think by kickoff, it was largely full, but it did look very, very worrying for a while. I'm sure it was very scary for people involved in that.
Yeah, absolutely. And Charles, just the final point on this section is looking ahead to Japan, really, to sort of quickly get an assessment of what we're expecting from that game. I don't think any of us are very high on Japan. This isn't your 2019, 2015 Japan side who can threaten the very best based on what we've seen of their warm-up games this summer and what we saw last autumn as well.
And against Chile, where they only just sort of got by them, didn't they? Yeah, I mean, I think it'll be more of the same. More of the same from England. I don't think they'll try and reinvent the wheel. I think, as most people know, stopping a drop goal is actually really quite difficult. And so even if teams know what's coming, if they continue on with this drop goal strategy tactic just to keep the scoreboard ticking over against most teams, it should pay dividends for them. It really should, because really all you can do to stop it, if you've got somebody who's very good at it, is get up immensely quickly, make sure you're onside and charge it down. Well, that's easier said than done. I think they'll be very physical again. The set piece looks excellent. They'll certainly try and squeeze Japan there. I can't envisage tons and tons of changes, because they'll want to build momentum after a sort of underwhelming August period. So, but certainly sitting here this week in comparison to last week, there is a much more sunshine around England than the sort of August clouds.
Right, let's get into the rest of the weekend's action, and we're going to start focusing on the arguably the game of the opening round, and it might end up being the game of the tournament, Wales against Fiji. And we're going to hear me having a chat with Shane Williams. Shane, thanks so much for joining us on the Telegraph Rugby podcast. It's a few hours after Wales' game against Fiji and Bordeaux, which was lively, to say the least. What are your immediate reflections on it?
Yeah, lively, what a word. It was just best game of the World Cup so far, end-to-end stuff. And you kind of expect that with Fiji, really. Probably not the game Wales want to get drawn into. However, what a spectacle. And I thought the crowd were fantastic. I thought both teams absolutely gave it their all. I'm just a little bit worried about how much that's taken out of Wales, to be honest with you. But it wasn't the perfect performance from them. In fact, they were quite poor in a lot of areas. Discipline was certainly an issue. I think Warren Gatland's already highlighted that. But, you know, they'd have learnt a lot from that game as well. And all credit to Fiji. Stayed in it right to the end. And I think what was impressive for me as well, Gatland's been talking about the Welsh fitness and the fact they could finish games strongly. But, you know, I think Fiji were the stronger team in the end of the game there. And, well, they were the stronger team. So, huge performance by them. I do feel a little bit for them. But I also do think Wales did enough in that in the third quarter to kind of win that match. But what a game.
It's a good point about getting drawn into it, because at times it felt like Wales were almost trying to out Fiji, sort of passing in their own 22. And we saw Dan Biggar having a polite word with George North just on half time, didn't we?
Yeah, well, the game can always open up against Fiji, because that's the style of rugby they play, and they probably want to draw you into that game. And why not when you're that comfortable with ball in hand? But yeah, there was a couple of incidents in the 22 where, you know, I was up on my seat saying, even I was saying, get the ball down there, get it out. But look, you know, Wales tried. Certainly with Dan, I've been there myself. I've had the hair dryer treatment off him as a young 18-year-old coming into the Ospreys, bossing the likes of me and Alan Wynne-Jones and Adam Jones around when he hadn't even played a match for the Ospreys. That's the character he is. He's a warrior. You know, he wants to win. And, you know, just screaming at George North, who's got, 115 caps, twice. He had it twice, the treatment twice before half-time there. But, you know, I'm sure he'd apologise to him for that. But, you know, if you can have that kind of commitment and that desire and passion from all your teammates, then I think you'd do okay.
Yeah, I think you're right. We spoke to Warren Gatland in the press conference afterwards, and he mentioned that he didn't actually mind seeing that from one player to another, kind of keeping them honest. And also something we didn't know about Biggar, that it was his mum's birthday the day of the game on Sunday, and that therefore there was a lot more kind of emotion behind it. This is his last campaign with Wales. I mean, how much are they going to miss him when he goes?
Yeah, look, he wears his heart in his sleeve, doesn't he, Dan? And bless him. But look, they will miss him. I think I thought he was superb yesterday. You know, he grew as the game went on. He took a hit early on as well. He was limping and holding his hip quite early on in the game. But again, like I said, a warrior that just keeps going. He inspires others around him. And, you know, if yesterday's performance is anything to go by, then, you know, you question why he's decided to hang up his boots for Wales. But, look, yeah, there's good tens coming through the ranks. You've got Sam and Anscombe that we'll be learning a lot from him during this campaign as well. And yeah, it is a shame, because I think, you know, I think there's a little bit more to come from Dan as well, not only as a player and what he does on the field, but, you know, to inspire others in training, his commitment, his passion. You know, there'd be tens watching his performance, young tens watching his performance that yesterday, thinking, you know, that's what I want to give to Wales. You know, I want to be screaming at players and telling them what to do and do what I'm doing, because he is an inspiration. But he'll definitely be missed.
There were so many things Wales did well, so I sort of want to focus on those first. You mentioned the tackle count. I just checked it this morning. It's up to 253, which is absurd, really, and 27 alone for Will Rowlands, which is an awful lot for a lock. That's going to drain a lot out of them. Jack Morgan's developed this ability to do crossfield kicks and clearance kicks, which I don't think was fully planned, but came off. What are the big positives for Wales sort of at that performance? It's the strongest side we've seen Gatland select. Obviously, the warm-ups was a bit varied, but when he had that first-choice team on the field, they looked pretty in control for the first 65 minutes or so.
Yeah, I think so, yeah. I think, you know, they stuck to their game plan. They wanted to get their set pieces right. They were going to kick a lot. They were going to try to put Fiji under pressure and tie the numbers in and then go wide, which they did. Josh Adams' try was a good example of that. Jack Morgan's crossfield kick, it's not the prettiest kick he'll ever do, or probably might be the last kick he ever does, to be fair, but you know, it came off in the end, and this was all after good sustained pressure for about 20 minutes from Wales, when Fiji had controlled the second quarter then, really. Look, there's lots of positives to take from it. Certainly when they did play the ball and they kept the ball well and transferred up to the tackle, they looked dangerous. So they need to take that into the next game. But like I said earlier, there's certainly a lot. The discipline was an issue. Even though there was a lot of tackles, you're going to expect missed tackles. I thought Will Rowlands was superb to make that amount of tackles. He carried well as well. Jack Morgan made a lot of tackles. Gareth Thomas made 21 tackles, I believe, as well. So, you know, that just goes to show the commitment's there. It will put him in good stead moving forward. I hope there's not too many injuries or niggles after a battle like that, because, you know, there's bound to be. But they'd have learnt a lot from that game as well. And what they are, they're going to be hardened after that. You know, sometimes when you play your first game and you're winning by 40, 50, 60 points, you know, you're not quite prepared for what's coming next. But they'll definitely be prepared for a big one after that Fiji game.
And just on the discipline, they sort of had that run of penalties where they were backed up on their own line sort of midway through the second half, and three sort of kind of cynical fouls and maybe a touch lucky to not get a yellow card there, given that Fiji then up the other end collapsed them all. And yeah, it's cynical in a yellow card, but arguably it should have happened to Wales just before.
Yeah, 100%. Look, as commentators, we were looking, thinking that there was a number of infringements for penalties that were just cynical, stopping Fiji get that momentum and that go forward. I think Elliot Dee might have been lucky twice in a row where, you know, on his line he's given a penalty away there. But that, you know, that is the game. But I think with the Fiji, it looked like if that driving line out would have kept going, it may have been a try. And I think for that reason, perhaps the card was given. You do feel it was just the timing of that penalty, I suppose, and people will question that. But you know, I think with the ref, he was trying to keep the game flowing. He was trying to keep the game a spectacle as it was. But yes, I do believe that probably a yellow card should have come out earlier, and it probably should have been for a red jersey, but it wasn't the case. I can assure you this week in training, Warren Gatland would address that massively, collectively as a team and individually, because there were some players that were giving penalties away, cynical penalties or silly penalties, as Gatland would probably call them, and it was repeat offenders. So yeah, they learn a lot this week after that game, I can assure you.
Given the way the draw pans out, given how strong Wales look for the first 65 minutes, they are contenders to sort of go far in this tournament.
Yeah, look, everyone's a contender in the World Cup. It's a crazy tournament. It's a fantastic tournament where, you know, you're going to have upsets. You're going to have, you know, teams that you usually expect to perform that are underperform. You're going to have teams who've probably have limped into the World Cup and then become world contenders, and that's certainly the case. That Australia could be one of those teams, certainly. But Fiji has been on everyone's radar. It really has. And you know, they're a team that where they've got class individually, and all of a sudden they look like they know what they're doing as 15s for 80 minutes. So they'll be a team people will be looking out for. There's a lot of really, really good sides that can win this World Cup. It's probably the most open World Cup I've witnessed. And I'm really looking forward to see how it all pans out. But you know, we're only in week one. We're only in match one. It's exciting already. Some fantastic rugby being played. Some great individual players out there. And it's only going to get bigger and better as the tournament goes on. But you know, I still can't call this one.
Fiji naturally will be very disappointed from that. But yeah, the prospects of that game on Sunday. Could you see them beating Australia? I mean, Australia got that win over Georgia, and Georgia have been playing quite well.
Look, yeah, definitely. You know, Georgia are always a tough, sticky opponent to play first. You don't really know what to expect. They're renowned for their forward play and their aggression up front, but they do have a bit of pace and a bit of flair behind as well. And I think Australia did all the right things. They played the right rugby, played in the right areas. took their points and tries when they came, and it was a good, tough first match, which is exactly what you need. And you know, it's an interesting pool now, isn't it, all of a sudden? But you know, going back to what you asked earlier, with Wales, one game under their belt, one win, it might sound like a really silly thing to say, but you win the first game, you know, you're heading towards the quarterfinals. They won't be looking that far ahead, I can assure you, because Australia are going to, and it could be certainly a match, but you know, like I said earlier, the likes of Australia, even Fiji. Fiji beat Australia next week. Now it's going to open it all up massively, and then all of a sudden Australia are chasing to get out of that pool. So, you know, that's what a World Cup's all about, really. But you know, there's a number of teams just within that pool that can go very far in this competition.
Just two final ones to finish. Which players in this Wales side are you sort of most excited by, not just based on last night but coming into the tournament? I mean, Jack Morgan's obviously, for a young captain, doing well, sort of handling that and still delivering in good performances. Who else sort of excites you in this side?
Yeah, well, it's, you know, it's always going to be the wingers for me. I'm a big Lewis Rees-Sammet fan. You know, we saw a couple of opportunities. He had a couple of opportunities on last night to kind of find some space. But you can see he's hungry to get involved. Probably doesn't get enough ball as he should, in my opinion. But I think that'll come as the tournament comes on. When the games open up, you know, any kind of space, this man is absolute lightning. So you know, I want to see him get involved a little bit more. And I suppose it's, you know, we mentioned Jack Morgan, but it'd be interesting to see how he goes, and Dewi Lake, both of them as co-captain. I want to see Dewi Lake get involved in the World Cup as it goes on. I know he's had a couple of injuries and then niggles afterwards, but he was out there warming up before the match and was looking good. He was looking lean, he was looking big. He was that anyway. You know, he's a big man, he's a strong man, but he's someone that Warren Gatland has looked at now as an inspiration to the others and a leader. But you can only do that when you're on the field. So hopefully now Dewi Lake gets fit and we can see him involved in the next match.
That was Shane Williams. Really appreciate him taking the time to chat to me the morning after that crazy game in Bordeaux. Just wanted to touch on the sort of end, the midway through the second half, and the discipline point that I think riled a lot of people up and led to a lot of people accusing kind of referee Matthew Carley of maybe being a bit unfair to Fiji. Fiji flanker Tagitaribuyu was yellow carded for collapsing a mall. I think the problem people have is that yellow card for collapsing a mall is fair enough.
Stonewall.
Because mall starts on the 20, he comes in at the side when it gets to about the 6 metre line and collapses it. You know, the mall's probably going to be a try, but it's not close enough for Matthew Carley to feel that he should award a penalty try, so he gives him a yellow card. You can't really argue with that. Maybe in a very unlikely situation, he could have said, right, that's one, and you're getting a warning. But it was almost too cynical. I think the issue that people have is before that, you've got Wales at the other end of the field defending on their own line, and you've got three penalties for offside. The middle one from Bigger is pretty cynical coming through when the ball, you know, like, that's pretty blatant right under the posts. And then the other two penalties are by the same player, Elliot D., and all three penalties are offside. Now, we often see if a team's backed up like that and it's different offences, so say one player comes in the side, one player doesn't roll away, you know, and one player's offside, you often see refs not give a yellow card because they're like, right, it's not the same offence, so I'm not going to, you know, not going to send you off. But I think three offsides in a row in that area.
Do you have to give a warning? Can you, persistent offending? Can you just go, that's persistent offending, see ya?
I mean, there's nothing in the laws about it, but that'd be very rare. Mm-hmm. I think for a referee to yellow card someone for persistent offending without having given them a warning would be eventually rare.
I don't know whether he's tucking in his shirt, but I thought he was going to go for the third one, it looked like, initially on the telly.
And they were lucky to not have one at the end as well. Was it Liam Williams? Yeah, Liam Williams offside at the end. I mean, when they'd already had the warning, they'd already had the yellow card, Fiji pushing for the win, and Wales infringed. I mean, they were lucky to not have one there. I mean, I think, yes, there's sort of two strands here. Yes, I think Wales got away with one there. But also, did it affect the result of the game? We'll never know. There, as you touched on, Colsey, there are two different sort of things at play here. A lot of the sort of comments and narrative and reaction on Twitter has been, how can that Fiji yellow be correct if Wales didn't also have a yellow card? And I'm not sure that's an avenue we should be going down either, because, you know, two wrongs don't make a right. The Fiji one was completely stonewall. It was very cynical. It was borderline penalty try, whereas none of the Wales ones were quite as cynical, and you wouldn't have been debating a penalty try for any of the Welsh offences, for instance.
No, you wouldn't have said penalty try. The bigger one is pretty cynical.
It is pretty cynical.
Watching it back, given where Fiji are right under the posts, it's sort of like...
The Wales one is for a build-up of indiscipline, is why the yellow should have come, rather than any sort of out-and-out offence, and that is different. And maybe, given how difficult the referee's job is now, and the fact that they have... two assistant referees, a TMO, and two people in the bunker helping them out. Maybe someone could have just got in Matthew Carley's ear and just said, if he'd lost track, that's three penalties for offside down here against Wales now, just to remind him if he'd lost track. Because I can imagine, you know, these are human, these referees. It is the best crop of referees in terms of their physical attributes and their mental training that the game has ever seen. But they are human, and human error... they will never, ever be flawless.
To clarify what I tweeted at the time, it wasn't a wild yellow card for the Fiji flank. It was just wild that it had happened.
Oh, yeah.
Wales, no, absolutely. Literally up the other end of the field, and got away with it.
The irony.
And as these things work out, Biggar doesn't get yellow carded, bangs like a brilliant 50-22 down the field, and they get the line out. And then from the mall, who scores? It's D. He's just giving away two offside penalties. Like... you know,
you couldn't write it.
And then, Corey Dobuchowski for his yellow card straight afterwards for offside, where Carly's like, that's a warning, gives away the stupidest one of the lot, arguably. Yeah. Anyway,
yeah,
that's refereeing. Hope we've cleared that up a bit. Just wanted to have a quick word on Dan Biggar, who was fully revved up, like to the max, 10 out of 10. This made more sense afterwards, didn't it, Charles, when we sort of heard from Warren Gatland and from Biggar himself?
So afterwards... obviously, there was that moment at half-time where Wales, for some reason, when Fiji knocked on in the Wales 22, Wales thought that it was on. It was on with the clock in the red, half-time, leading. They thought it was on. And they sort of butcher a bit of a counter-attack that was never really on. Get pushed into touch. And Biggar storms over to George North and gives him the proper what for. Has a real go at him. I think he has a bit of verbal at Nick Tompkins on the floor as well. Storms into the changing rooms. Him and Neil Jenkins are going at it as well. And then afterwards, Gatland and Biggar are both asked about it. Gatland said he had no problem with it whatsoever. He actually quite liked it. And Biggar said, just all sort of water off the duck's back. George and I have had these robust conversations for the past 15 years. And we were laughing and joking afterwards, and it wasn't even mentioned.
I loved that. It should be said that he was probably lucky to escape a sanction for that tackle on Semirandradra, which was very upright, wasn't it?
Yes.
But that moment, it was a 50-metre bollocking, wasn't it? Because it happened in close to Wales' try line, but he just kept going for the whole way to the tunnel, which was on halfway. His reaction to his own 50-22, great as well. Yeah. Just love that heart on the sleeve stuff is why we watch it, and those guys are... In the most intense environment imaginable, so that emotion is just great to see.
I know he rubs some people up the wrong way, but I think we'll all miss him when he sort of retires internationals after this tournament. Let's jump to the other games. We'll start with France against New Zealand. Charles, just give us a flavour of the atmosphere and actually, particularly as France sort of edged further and further ahead, and everyone was like, "Ah, it's all right, we're going to be okay." How was it?
First half, nervy, real nervy, real cagey, gripping, compelling. No one, even in the kick tennis battles, that's the most compelling kick tennis I think I've ever watched. Nobody could take their eyes off it. The atmosphere was electric, but the game didn't really spark until. Well, in terms of the atmosphere, because obviously New Zealand scored the first try and stunned the crowd. It was silent at the Stade de France after that try. The game didn't really sort of kick to life from a host point of view until the second half, and then they did sort of run away with it a bit, didn't they? I mean, the first half, New Zealand, the fear in a sort of wider picture is that New Zealand looked half decent, certainly in that first half, looked decent. And France didn't really. They were a bit subpar and have still won by 14 points. And actually, even in the first half where New Zealand looked much the better side, France went in at half-time leading. And once that happened, you were sort of like, well, we all know what's happening here.
This isn't the most sharp tactical insight that you'll ever get, but it looked like New Zealand was just missing a bit of biff. They had
no
a couple of clever, no Shannon Frizzell. They had a couple of really clever bits in there for the first try, that little short ball that sends Rico Ioane through, and then Beauden Barrett's kick pass to Talia, and then Ardie Surveyor's chip from first phase was so intelligent, really deceptive. But then they just sort of, as teams do against France and South Africa, teams have got a good kicking game, go hard at the defensive breakdown, and are just robust, got a lot of big men. They just couldn't find a foothold. And I think that was what Ian Foster was saying afterwards, wasn't it?
Yeah, and I think France actually lacked that as well in the first half. And I think they realised, because obviously Donty wasn't fit, Moefana played at 12, and the jury's still out on him as an international 12.
No Valemza, no Donty.
Two big blokes. So I think when they took Wilkie off and brought Taufa Fanua on, and when they moved Fiku to 12 and brought Vanson on, suddenly they were getting over the gain line more frequently. They had a stronger bench than New Zealand's, and that's, I think, why there was a 14-point gap by the end of it. I think, which could have been more, because I think that Penno try with the amazing Ramos offload, I think if they'd have looked at that closer, I think that was not backed by New Zealand. So it could have even been a 21-point victory for France.
Damien Penno's grin it should be terrifying for other teams, because if a host side with that much talent is not sort of one of the only chances I think you've got that they slip up, is this expectation weighing on them. And with him, I don't know whether as a collective it might be different, but that was one thing we were worried about, wasn't it? That sort of expectation weighing heavy, and Benno just looked like he was strolling around.
Can you imagine coaching him at sort of schoolboy level and going, no, Damien, run straight.
Nah.
Okay, no, you don't need to, actually. You just do what you like.
No need. I can't remember who player of the match was. Was it Aldrin?
Yeah. But, and sure. for my 2p worth of buyer, country
he
mile.
He was outstanding.
And
he really was.
Completely outplayed Ardie Surveyor as well. Not that that's how it works in a sort of one-on-one battle, but if you were to take the two number eights.
Mentioning that Surveyor chip, actually, quite a good weekend for Bat Rose. Because you had that, and you had Jack Morgan's crossfield kick to Rhys Sammet, where Jack Morgan afterwards just said, yeah, it was meant to be meant to go to Biggs, but I was there. So
I thought
I'd complete the set play move.
Benno with a couple as well, although Benno has one probably slightly overhit on the far touchline, might have stayed in. But just nice that these players, if they're you know, there's the conviction, and I think it's going to be a theme, is players with the conviction to find space however they can find space. That's what makes good attacks.
Oh, there was a chip from Movaca as well, from France down the touchline early on. Oh, and that leads us on to another little prediction failure, and this time it is on my part. I had Julien Marchand as player of the tournament as my prediction. He's gone after 16 minutes.
Yeah, we'll let you off though if it's injuries. I think that's okay. It's more form falling off a cliff where those calls look a bit silly.
I think
they've dropped him from the squad because his forms fell off a cliff. Exactly.
My prediction for player of the tournament, Willy Larue, was after about 24 hours after recording, was named on the bench. So. Not going great.
We need a whole pod at some point just to chat about your love of Willy Larue, because it's always been there, but it's accelerating rapidly as we've got to this World Cup. Speaking of Willy Larue and South Africa, that's a lovely segue, Charlie, to Marseille and Sunday's game. Not for South Africans, obviously, all just a little bit disappointing that we didn't quite get. Got a first half humdinger, and then the second half, Scotland just really faded quite badly, didn't they?
Scotland's forwards in the first half were phenomenal. A mall stop at around, I think it was half an hour, and then that led, I think, I can't remember how they were sort of dotted around that mall stop, but two really big scrum penalties. That is so impressive to be doing that against the box, and I think they might even have got a little bit more out of that scrum battle. I think they were probably hard done by on a couple of calls. South Africa did really... Finn Russell was really well contained. Jesse Creel should have gone very early on for that high tackle on Dempsey. That's the reddest red out of the incidents that we saw this weekend. I think he's always upright. He's pressing aggressively in that channel because that was clearly part of the game plan, and we know that because subsequently he was doing that, and that was actually doing a really good job of cutting off Finn Russell's options. I think he should have gone.
And yet, we understand not even a sighting.
Not even a sighting, no. So Richard Smith might be able to use that to Curry's advantage.
So we get why you're confused at home.
Of course.
Basically. Mm.
Of course. Notwithstanding South Africa's, the connection in South Africa's defence, how they're reading one another, how they are scrambling is really, really impressive. If it's a different game, if Scotland take their chances, obviously, and Darcy Graham should have fed Duan van der Merwe off that really clever little swivel from Tui Pilotu that breaks South Africa from the line out. But in that second half, when it's just so difficult to contain that South Africa power from the bench, because they just replenish that front row and it's really, really difficult. It was kind of a bitty game because of the conditions making it difficult to handle. But kind of a, almost like a slow burner, sort of quite fascinating one nonetheless.
Mm. I was going to say, does 18-3 do South Africa a bit of a disservice for how in control they were, or do you reckon?
I don't know, because Scotland missed those chances, yeah. And South Africa took them. The Toy try rewards that period of dominance that they have, which is a really good reaction at the start of the second half. And Libok's no look kick pass to Arenza is frankly stunning.
Filth.
Can I just ask for a general assessment on him and how he played? Because obviously there's a lot of intrigue in him with Andre Pollard back training with Leicester, seemingly and fit, but not in the World Cup squad unless an injury happened. So Libok is the man at the moment. How did he look?
What's really interesting. His whippy passing game gives South Africa width that has kind of epitomised how they've gone about this four-year cycle, and one thing that they really wanted to get better at, because it just facilitates others and gives them, just makes you have to spread the field in defence. His and that kick pass game, he'd lobbed one over Graham, I think, with his left foot really early on in the game. So again, you're on as an opposing wing, you have to be on alert. And with Colby and Arenza, they can hold that width and punish you if the decision making of the defensive wings is a little bit off. The tee might become a problem, his kicking from the tee might become a problem, and Faf de Klerk,
the actual tee,
and then Faf de Klerk took over later on in the game. What was really interesting was during the press conference, there was a completely fair question, I thought, about Libok's kicking and whether South Africa would have to adapt, whether that would become a problem. Jacques Naba answered the question saying it's not a problem if he's man of the match, which I'm sure should have been man of the match anyway, but by the by. And then Sia Khaleesi stepped in after there'd been a second question saying, can I just go back to the question on Manny's kicking? This game is about sort of being a team and covering for once for other people's faults. And he said, look, I sometimes don't know what I'm calling in the lineup. I've got Eben Etzebeth and Dwayne Vermeulen to talk me around the field when that happens. It was a real, I don't know whether it was a set piece, I don't know whether he had in his head that he was going to say that, but it was just a really impressive piece of leadership by Sia Khaleesi. That said, it probably doesn't change the fact that South Africa needs to kick their goals, or will need to kick their goals later on in the
when
tournament.
When it gets down to crunch time. Just to finish the round up with Ireland against Romania, which I watched in Bordeaux. And Ireland, fine. Kind of expected. We'd spoken about Romania's pretty disastrous form coming into this tournament anyway, because they shipped 56 points to Georgia and 57 to Italy. So it was almost like, well, are Ireland going to get 100? And at one point, it looked as though they might do. But Romania, actually, to their credit, had spells of defence where they kept Ireland out for like 10, 15 minutes.
Well, I was going to say, also at one point, it looked like Ireland might lose. So,
well, yeah. I mean, within the first 2 minutes. I mean, obviously, the focus was on Sexton and like, how was Sexton going to go? And it was a bit unfortunate that grubber kick that he was sent towards the right wing looking for Keith Earls just fell perfectly for the Romania fly half to be like, oh, amazing, thanks so much. I'll pick this up and like run it down the touchline and give it to the scrum half Rapani to score a try. So Romania had the perfect start. And actually that was almost quite nice because you were like, oh, well, at least you've had this because, you know, now Ireland can sort of take you to the cleaners a little bit, which they did. Bundyaki was awesome. And I know
he really was.
I know you can't sort of, you maybe shouldn't read too much into it given the opposition, but he was just brilliant.
Looked sharp. He looked sharp in the England game as well, didn't he?
Yeah, there is sort of that mini 12 debate, isn't there, for Ireland, of do you go with Aki or Henshaw to partner Ringrose? Mm. And Henshaw...
Does Ringrose have to start, do you think?
Well, I'm struggling to remember the last time that they went Aki Henshaw off the top of my head.
England, but it's not alien. Like it does happen.
Mm. I think they like Ringrose.
Aki couldn't even get in the squad a year ago. What a comeback.
Was that a bit of subtle, like, I don't know, Eddie/Steve Borthwick-esque man management of like, no, you're not in this squad, go away and work on things.
Yeah, probably.
Come back.
But if it was, it's worked.
I mean, he looked sensational. Joe McCarthy, the unlock, is really fun. He got a try and he kind of looks like he's part of the 23 now. I mean, he's as close to a bolter, I guess, as they've got in the squad because he came into the setup quite late, but he looks really handy. Yeah, they were just... It was mainly being impressed by Aki and watching Sexton and seeing how Sexton went. And yeah, apart from that early mistake, you know, passing was slick, tackle well. He scored two tries. Can't remember the last time Johnny Sexton scored two tries in a test.
Crash ball for the second one as well.
Yeah, off a short ball.
Do they beat South Africa?
I can't wait for it. Oh yeah, there was nothing here to make you think no. And even though South Africa's power is sort of unrelenting, I could see Ireland winning that. Yeah, I think they just look pretty slick.
I agree, which means we've got on the back of those predictions, we're looking at Ireland New Zealand quarter with France against France South Africa probably.
Yeah. Can't wait.
Goodness me.
Really excited.
It's early days.
Just one final thing in the game. It was almost funny watching James Lowe run around and just be completely unable to get a try. Like, he tried on the left wing and Ireland would break through and he'd just be there like, me now? Like, pass to me? And then they cut inside and score. And then he switched to the right at the end and was like just not in the breakaways and was just running around going, I'm not going to get it. I had vested interest with my fantasy team, so I was sort of waiting for it.
I had Keith Earls in my fantasy team.
Ah.
And okay. I was watching, he was, a couple of balls slipped out of his hands in the opposition 22, and I was, just sad.
Very, very final point. The final Ireland try, Klopp was in the red. They were in their own 22. Matt Hanson was running around, as Andy Farrell said, like he was playing under 12s. And they scored an awesome breakaway try, probably their best of the lot. I thought that was pretty cool, like that intent to play. And yeah. They look good. They look like the number one side in the world. I know that's a really obvious thing to say, but they look good. Okay, some of your questions and thoughts. Thank you very much for sending in what I think we decided was a record number of questions after the opening weekend. So we really appreciate it. Thank you very much. We've just we've cherry-picked a few, and we're starting with a question from Mark, who says, I need Charles Richardson's take on getting asked after by Eddie Jones. Is this the start of a beautiful friendship? Charles, tell us what's going on with you and Eddie. Are you best buds?
Yeah, it might be the start of a beautiful friendship. We'll wait and see how it plays out. Thank you to everybody who has bombarded me with messages and feedback over the past 48 hours, asking me if I'm going to uppercut myself and telling me how much I've been mugged off. And although there is someone who said who went into bat for me and said, Eddie, Charles will come and watch you if you get out of the group. So that was quite nice. If you're unaware of the context of this, in the post-match press conference for Australia v Georgia on Saturday, Eddie asked where I was after I asked a question on Thursday in his pre-match press conference that he didn't really like very much. The irony being that I was actually at the Australia-Georgia game and thought that Australia looked quite handy and wrote as much in the pages of the Daily Telegraph and on the Telegraph Sport website. I wrote that before the press conference, and actually because the press conference had been delayed so much and was clashing with the England match, and it was just at the moment where Tom Curry was being sent off, I wasn't in the room. I was sort of hiding around the corner. But if I'd have known that he was going to call me out so publicly, I would have hung around to respond to him. And now I feel like I've let down the global rugby fraternity.
Really like the idea of you walking back into the press room and like some fireworks going off and your theme music hitting. And
that would have gone viral.
Coming down the ramp to address him. Let's actually hear some audio of that moment right now.
To maybe Luke Pearce liked us. Where was that? Where's that Pommy bloke from? Where was he from? Daily Telegraph, one of my favourite newspapers. Where's he? He's not here today. I bet if we lost, he'd be here. Might have to send him an invitation, know his name? Charles. Charles, are you out there, mate? No. Okay.
Our next question is from Jim, who asks, was Tom Curry's red card the Johnny Bairstow, Alex Carey moment? Can they get crossed without a similar incident? That's true. Like, do England basically need to be affronted by something? I mean, they love a red card. To then sort of, you know...
A couple of things here. First, it reminds me a little bit of David Brent and faking his high blood pressure. Second, I bumped into Dmitry Yashvili, who said, I don't think England win that game without the red card because it focuses their game plan on kick chase and everything like that. And that's an interesting point. You'd hope that they now clear up. They've shown now that they don't need to potentially be intense to the point of reckless, because they can be really, really disciplined and they can be hard-nosed at the same time, and they can really have that intent and that intensity. So you'd hope that it can be a spur, actually, for them, because they can do it in a controlled way and they can certainly carry out a tactical plan. Absolutely. I think it's quite an interesting comparison from Jim.
It's like a fascinating parallel universe, isn't it? How do England play out if they don't have a red card and they're 15 players? Do they try and do what they... I feel like they'd be better in defence and probably better at set piece, and they probably still win, but I'd love to know how they win.
Better at everything. Yeah.
I think actually the sort of the burning question is does George Ford drop all those goals if they've still got 15? I'd love to know that. We'll never know. Well, we might find out against Japan, where if they keep 15 players on the field and George Ford kicks 3 drop goals, then that'll answer the question, I guess. But then, no, we still won't know, because that might be the butterfly effect, and it's come from what happened in Argentina. We will never know.
I touched on it earlier. If he doesn't break De Beer's record in this World Cup by landing 6 drop goals, very, very disappointed. The next question is from SB Keane, who says it's more of a comment. The new longer World Cup format is rubbish, and there are too many days off. It loses momentum and lets negative takes grow. Need to expand to 24 teams and bring back midweek games. So basically what's happening now is that we had Wales-Fiji kick off on Sunday night at 8 p.m. UK time, and it's going to be 96 hours until we get France-Uruguay on Thursday night at the same time. So you've got this sort of three-day breathing space, is how I would almost describe it, to sort of process what's happened and look ahead. But obviously in past World Cups, we've had games on Tuesdays and games on Wednesdays. And how do we sort of feel, Charlie, I'll come to you first, how do we sort of feel about this sort of down period between games?
I think it's a really fair point. I think for a couple of reasons. First off, I really think that point about negativity growing is really important. And then the second one is actually quite like, and you've got to say this obviously with the caveat that player welfare is really important, but I quite like how the short turnarounds cause teams to sort of juggle the resources within their 33-man squad. So two reasons why I quite like that take.
Yeah, I'm all for it too. Obviously, the obvious reservations and obvious drawbacks to a 24-team tournament are you know, sort of equality, landslide wins, are 24 teams ready, safety issues. But then we've just seen Ireland put 80 points on Romania, so we've got them anyway, so why not broaden it out to 24 teams and maybe allow sort of Spain, Chile to have their day, because Chile playing another developing emerging nation and beating them would actually probably be massive for Chilean rugby, but they're probably not going to get that opportunity at this World Cup, are they? I mean, fingers crossed they do, but I, now that they've lost to Japan, I can't see them doing it.
Yeah, I think if you're getting shorter turnarounds, you need bigger squads. So you need like 38, 39 player squads so that you can actually properly rotate players and you're not burning them out in short windows, which I appreciate is more logistics and less fun when it comes to squad cutdowns, but actually it means that you're protecting players and not flogging them sort of too much during those games. And just the very final one from Elliot, he says it's slightly punchy, but given the weekend was dominated by TMO debates, is the answer just to have less TMO involvement? Most people accept 99% of refereeing calls, maybe. However, since the TMO's remit has increased, so is the controversy. Go back to TMO's deciding tries only. I mean, Friday night we had a game where the France-New Zealand game, where it felt like replays were scarce and TMO involvement was quite light at times, and Jakob Paper was sort of just like letting stuff go and letting the game flow a bit. So is that what we like?
My fear is that it leads to more clips of breakdown side entries and people going, well, have you seen this? This was in the lead up to the X try, and that should have been picked up. That would be my fear.
But is that not because we have a culture over-analysis and micro-analysis and magnifying glasses at the minute, whereas if we stripped it back and the whole culture of the sport and the whole rugby-playing fan base was able to accept mistakes more frequently, then I think it's fine. I'm all for this, for the record, and I've written it today in The Telegraph and on The Telegraph website that I think that rugby is micromanaged, it's overly refereed, it's over-officiated. I would strip back the TMO completely to foul play and egregious try-scoring errors. Other than that, maybe not even that, maybe just foul play I would have, because it would cause a lot of controversy and a big storm at the start. But then as soon as people got used to it, as soon as people realised that actually referees are human, they are not flawless, and there are going to be mistakes, no matter how many TMOs, no matter how many referees we have, there are always going to be mistakes. And as soon as a rugby-playing public and us come to terms with that, I think it will be better for the game long-term, because there are always going to be errors. Look at James Lowe in the Six Nations. Look at that France pass for the second New Zealand try. The pass for the second New Zealand try against France on Friday night was forward, not picked up. These things are always going to continue, and we've got so many eyeballs on everything, so much technology, and yet they're still there. They're still dominating the narrative.
So a bit more rubber the green, basically.
Yeah.
And eventually everyone will accept that, you know, the universe balances out.
Quite.
Okay. Yeah, I think that's a good proposal. Right, that is it for today. Thank you, Charlie. Thank you, Charles. What is your respective schedules for the week ahead? I'm going to be in Nantes on the Saturday for Ireland against Tonga, and then St Etienne on Sunday for Australia-Fiji, which could be quite lively. Charlie, what are you going to be doing?
Nice for me. Get to watch Portugal against Wales. Ooh. And then England-Japan.
I'm steering the ship from London this weekend for my sins, but actually I've had 10 days in Europe, and I'm actually quite glad of just sort of a few days. I wouldn't quite say rest and recuperation, but sort of a more chilled out few days after a very, very hectic fortnight.
Are you buying that Charles is happy to be out of France? Because I'm not for a split second, actually.
He'll be back soon enough.
With a heavy heart.
A big thank you to Shane Williams, our guest this week, and we'll be bringing you more big name interviews throughout the tournament. So please make sure that you spread the word to the rugby fans in your life and check out the podcast and subscribe. Enjoy all the action this weekend. We'll catch you next week. But until then, from all three of us, thank you and goodbye.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Hi, I'm Megan Rinks.
And I'm Melissa D. Montz.
And like every other person with access to a microphone, we started a podcast.
On Mondays, we release Don't Blame Me, which is an advice podcast where listeners call in and we share our thoughts on situations such as what to do if you're going to your boyfriend's family function and you haven't told him that you previously slept with both his twin brothers.
Then on Thursdays, we release our podcast, But Am I Wrong?, where we ethically gossip about pop culture, politics, our lives, and your lives. Listeners write in and we tell them if they're wrong or right in a situation. Are you the hero or the villain?
On Tuesdays and Fridays, we throw in a little something extra as well.
Well, something, something. We strive to create a community grounded in activism, mental health, and inclusivity. Think of us as like your blunt, honest friends who give you advice that you need to hear, not what you want to hear. But we're also always rooting for your success. What we lack in credentials, we make up for in
opinions.
We do that in every episode too.
We're professional unprofessional, so if you're looking for a new slate of podcasts to add to your routine, we're here for you.
Acast recommends.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.